You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
Welcome, brothers and sisters, comrades and friends. I am Siegfried, and this is Back in the USSR here on CFRU 93.3 FM. A few weeks ago, this show talked about the deadly events in Charlottesville, Virginia, last month, which at the time I mistakenly said was in North Carolina, and how brave anti-fascists shut down the biggest far-right rally that's been held in North America in years, in spite of the fascists having police protection, in spite of the lethal violence that the fascists used against the anti-fascists, which claimed the life of Heather Heyer and injured many others, and in spite of the demonization that the anti-fascists received and continue to receive from the mainstream media, which has done the utmost to equate fascist violence and anti-fascist self-defense as being somehow the same thing, which is just disgusting. Since then, the struggle has continued in Canada as well as the States, and even leftist figures like Chris Hedges have joined the mainstream media chorus condemning anti-fascist resistance as somehow helping the far right which is a position disturbingly similar to that expressed by Donald Trump. And actually, before we go any further, I'd like to quote Michael Parenti's analysis of this common technique by the mainstream media known as false balancing, which the capitalist press uses all the time when it wants to downplay right-wing violence while demonizing progressive forces fighting back against it. So this is from Michael's book, Contrary Notions. Goes like this. In accordance with the canons of good journalism, the press is supposed to tap competing sources to get both sides of an issue. In fact, both sides are seldom accorded equal prominence. One study found that from 1997 through 2005, conservative guests on network opinion shows outnumbered liberal ones, usually by 3-1, while leftist radicals were too scarce even to be counted. In sum, both sides of a story are usually not all sides. The whole left progressive and radical portion of the opinion spectrum is amputated from the visible body politic. False balancing was evident in a BBC report that spoke of a, quote, history of violence between Indonesian forces and Timorese guerrillas, with not a hint that the guerrillas were struggling for their lives against an Indonesian invasion force that had slaughtered some 200,000 Timorese. Instead, the genocidal invasion of East Timor was made to sound like a grudge fight, with killings on both sides. The U.S. supported wars in Guatemala and El Salvador during the 1980s were often treated with the same kind of false balancing. Both those who burned villages and those who were having their villages burned were depicted as equally involved in a contentious bloodletting, while giving the appearance of being objective and balanced. Such reports falsely neutralize their subject matter and thereby distort the issue. That's Michael Parenti on false balancing in the media. And of course, there are other dimensions to it as well, particularly with regard to this false equation between fascist violence and anti-fascist resistance. A recent article by the journalist Finian Cunningham noted how the Pentagon denounced American Nazis after the violence in Charlottesville, but continues to train and arm Nazis and Nazi sympathizers in the Ukraine in its ongoing aggressive campaign against Russia. Last week, I talked about how the CIA for years spent billions of dollars training and arming terrorist forces in Syria, which are effectively fascist and far-right in orientation as well, and certainly make it known their desire to exterminate whole ethnic and religious groups if they ever take power in the country, which thankfully is now extremely unlikely. But their genocidal violence has taken the lives of tens of thousands of civilians over the past 6 years in Syria and Iraq. To quote Finian Cunningham's article, quote, there is a long history of such American support for Nazis in Ukraine, going back to the end of World War II, when the Pentagon and CIA covertly backed the Galen Organization, a former Third Reich General Reinhard Galen and his Ukrainian Nazi partisans in their sabotage operations against the Soviet Union. Modern-day regiments under the control of the Kiev regime, such as the Azov Battalion, publicly self-identify with Nazi-collaborating descendants and former pro-Nazi Ukrainian leaders like Stefan Bandera. This neo-Nazi ideology of the Kiev-run military is a central impetus in why these forces have waged a three-year-long war on the ethnic Russian population of the breakaway Donbass region in eastern Ukraine. The latter refuses to recognize the legitimacy of the Kiev regime, which seized power in February 2014 in a coup d'etat against an elected government. The American CIA backed that violent coup. The Pentagon's supply of weaponry to Kiev forces will no doubt embolden their regiments to step up violations of the truce, which was supposed to be implemented under the Minsk Accord. Hundreds of breaches are reported on a weekly basis in which towns and villages in Donetsk and Luhansk come under fire from heavy artillery. Alexander Zakharchenko, the leader of the Donetsk People's Republic, has recently remarked that his defense forces are, quote, are not fighting Ukrainians, but rather Bandorites. That is, neo-Nazi militia, who adulate their Third Reich hero, Stefan Bandera, for assisting the German SS exterminate thousands of fellow Ukrainians deemed to be subhuman. And of course, these far-right Banderites are the people who set fire to the trade union building in the city of Odessa in 2014, slaughtering or burning alive dozens of unarmed left-wing demonstrators they had trapped there. And just as in Charlottesville, the police did essentially nothing to stop this lethal fascist violence from happening. So PR aside, the U.S. state is absolutely in bed with right-wing violence at home and worldwide. This is the case today, just as it was the case during the Cold War when the U.S. backed the Mujahideen in Afghanistan that gave rise to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and when they backed death squads and drug traffickers in Latin America, and even gave support to right-wing terrorists in Western Europe in Operation Gladio, to say nothing of how the FBI backed right-wing terrorism against the civil rights struggle in America and the black liberation struggle and against anti-war movements during the Vietnam War years, including operating hand-in-glove with the KKK to carry out massacres, such as the Greensboro Massacre, in its efforts to suppress progressive and revolutionary forces at home and abroad. The American state has been more than willing to empower the most murderous political forces imaginable, including outright fascists and Nazis. In the last Back in the USSR show concerning anti-fascism a few weeks ago, I said that the worst insult, the most intolerable thing that a communist can experience is being falsely equated with the fascist Nazi scum that they've been bravely fighting against since fascism first ever reared its ugly head in the early 20th century. Fascists hate communists for a reason, because communists have been the most dogged opponents of far-right violence from the beginning. And that remains the case today. I mean, in Charlottesville, you had American communist parties like the PSL, Workers' World Party. They were on the ground, they were there, they were fighting, they were struggling. And similar rallies in Berkeley, where, of course, people have confronted far-right violence more recently. You know, the PSL communists have been there. They've been on the ground. They've been resisting. They faced arrest. They faced violence. They've been there. They've been fighting against fascism on the front lines. See, we communists don't tolerate fascists. We don't tolerate sympathy for fascists. We do not debate fascists. We fight fascists. We seek the ultimate and total destruction of fascism everywhere in the world. And we are proud to say this. Bash the fash. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
We'd say that the ideas that they put forward outside football grounds on working class estates have to be combated politically, but also that they've got a physical agenda and that has to be met physically as well. People have to defend themselves against the fascists. They can't just turn the other cheek.
Back, belly burns out, who lost the death? Children are lost, but all gone in advance. Survive for a man, everyone learns.
Hey, you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Oi Polloi with Bash the Fash from 1993, British anti-fascist song. And I, of course, am Siegfried. And to be honest, I feel most of what I said about resisting fascism should be a no-brainer. I mean, we've witnessed the Holocaust. We've witnessed World War II. We've seen what fascists do. So why are people turning a blind eye to what's going on in Ukraine right now? You know, why are more people not calling out President Donald Trump on, you know, his racism and his anti-immigration policies and his like brutal support for far-right groups, and as opposed to accusing him of these bogus accusations of collaborating with Russia? Or, you know, why do people dismiss Charlottesville as an isolated incident when it clearly isn't? And why are people letting Canadian Foreign Minister Chrystia Freeland off the hook when she openly defends and celebrates her Nazi collaborating grandfather after his wartime deeds were recently exposed for all to see last year? Why? The struggle against fascism, which once united countless millions of people across the world, has tragically, heartbreakingly broken down. And this has a lot to do, in my opinion, with the demonization or systematic forgetting, sweeping aside of the communist, anarchist, and radical forces that fought so fiercely and effectively against fascism throughout the 20th century. Right from the beginning, we're in the streets fighting against the fascists, in the battlefield fighting against fascists on all levels, all sections of society fighting back against these forces, these far-right forces and the people collaborating with them. People don't know who their real heroes are, nor after decades of Cold War anti-communist propaganda do they know who their real enemies are. And this has to change. And now I could give you an example from the Spanish Civil War and the heroes of the International Brigades or the countless anti-fascist partisan heroes of World War II. But instead I want to give you a modern example of the Montreal-based anti-fascist activist Jaggi Singh, a man who the mainstream media has also made damn sure you've never heard of. And yet he's fighting the same fight against the same right-wing forces in your own backyard. And I want to read a public statement of solidarity with him after he was targeted by a far-right smear campaign and was then arrested as a result of that smear campaign by the police, by the Quebec police. So this is a public statement in solidarity with activist Jagjit Singh, arrested in Montreal for having, quote, impersonated Nordiques Michel Goulet in Quebec City. Not a joke. That's the actual title. And this was posted on 29th of August, 2017. It goes like this. Montreal, 29 August, 2017. This morning, August 29, Montreal activist Jagjit Singh was arrested and charged with resisting arrest and taking another person's identity for having jokingly given his name to police as former Quebec Nordiques player Michel Goulet on August 20th. He is being transferred to Quebec City, where he is to appear Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. in municipal court. This arrest came in the context of a far-right hate campaign targeting Jagjit, including a petition promoted by the notorious racist group La Meute, demanding his arrest. A campaign that has been taken up by right-leaning political figures and members of the media over the past week. More specifically, the absurd charges related to Jagjit's participation in an anti-fascist demonstration in Quebec City on August 20th, where he was briefly arrested. Close to 1,000 people took to the streets that day to protest against an anti-immigrant demonstration organized by the far-right group La Meute. Jagjit spent the entire demonstration talking on a megaphone, playing music, and dancing with children in front of the police. At a certain point, the police took him into custody, but then released him after just half an hour. At the time, he released a public statement on his arrest. While he was the only person arrested that day, Jagjit was not the organizer of the August 20th demonstration and had no official leadership role during that demonstration. Nonetheless, the far right in Quebec considers Jagjit to be a leader of a conspiracy of anti-fascists, the federal government, and nefarious global elites. On social media, fascists and conspiracy theorists share memes making him out to be a larger-than-life figure, a kind of local puppet master responsible for anything done by the far left in Montreal. As such, they blamed him for the August 20th demonstration, which La Meute humiliated inside a parking garage for hours, and for violent incidents which took place that day. An online petition demanding Jagjit be arrested and charged with various offenses was started by and disseminated by members of the far right, including members of La Meute, the Front Patriotique du Québec, Storm Alliance, and the Mouvement Républicain du Québec, amongst others. That the far right are scapegoating one person of color for all the opposition they encounter is not surprising. However, the situation was exacerbated within days of La Meute's August 20th defeat, as Quebec City Mayor Regis Laboum publicly blamed the, quote, Singh's gang, and was quoted in the media stating, "I hate Jagjit Singh," declaring him persona non grata in the provincial capital. The Journal de Montreal followed up with a hit piece entitled "Jagjit Singh Superstar" by Richard Martineau, as former PQ minister Bernard Drainville had Jagjit on his radio show and demanded that he condemn all of the violence that took place on the 20th, scoffing when Jagjit explained that he was simply one participant in a demonstration and not in a position to make any blanket condemnations. This is the toxic context in which Jagjit was arrested this morning. Not for the first time, political figures, journalists, and the far right have collaborated in developing a narrative which has subsequently had serious consequences for people's lives. This is a pattern which has played out repeatedly since the first racist reasonable accommodation crisis, and has only intensified through social media, especially in the current context against refugees crossing into Canada. While Singh is only one person, in no way anyone's leader, it is important to condemn this dynamic for the way in which it has been weaponized time and time again against social movements and oppressed people here. We are calling on progressive allies, anti-fascists, and those who care about civil liberties to show support to Jagjit and all the others targeted as a result of the August 20th demonstration, and by the far right more broadly. One way to do this is to be present to show your support at the Quebec City Municipal Courthouse tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Rides are being organized for Montreal. And that was from Alerta MTL at Antifa Zone. And you know, once again, we have to talk about the false balancing, right? That goes back to false balancing that, you know, we hear these, this one guy who wasn't even involved in, like, physically confronting fascists on that day in Quebec City on August 20th, and yet he was targeted. You know, and blamed for the violence that happened there and all this sort of stuff. And you know, there's all kinds of, once again, false balancing in the media, which equated the anti-fascist resistance with the violence perpetrated by the fascists, and this demonization that took place. And the demonization which was unleashed upon left-wing groups that confronted fascists on that day. You know, so I mean, it's the same kind of stuff which we saw around Charlottesville, except this is in Canada. So we need to understand, like, contrary to a very common stereotype that you get in Canada, the fact, like, okay, you know, a common thing that Canadians do is they look south of the border and they say, oh yeah, isn't that terrible and all that sort of stuff. No, it's happening here. Fascism is in Canada as well as in the United States and in other countries. Canada doesn't have immunity to far-right violence. And that needs to be understood. It needs to be very, very clearly understood. And certainly my comrade, Patrick, who of course used to actually run this show, back in 2013, he absolutely understands that because he himself is organizing against fascism in Ottawa. He's had to physically confront fascists and far-right demonstrators on a number of occasions. And I respect him, and he's a very brave guy for doing that and putting his body in harm's way, facing up to the far-right, facing up to fascism, which is not an easy thing to do. But once again, this is what communists, this is what anarchists, this is what different radicals have been doing since the time fascism first reared its ugly head, you know, and we will continue to fight against fascism in all its forms. And we'll also remember those heroes of our past who made the ultimate sacrifice in resisting fascism. And that's what this song's about. This is Christy Moore, Viva la Quinta Brigada, about the 15th Brigade of the International Brigades in the Spanish Civil War. In the 1930s. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
People, the tribes and the rise in such a time. Franco's eyes were the powerful and wealthy. Our clients came from the other side. Even the olives were bleeding. And the battles were with their lineage on the dawn. The truth and love against the force of evil. Brotherhood against the fascist hand. Viva la Quinta Brigada. No pattern on the pitch that made him fight. Adelante is the cry around the hillside. Let us all remember them tonight. Keep it going there now. From Derry came a brave young Christian brother. Side by side they fought and died in Spain. But Tommy Woods in 17 died in Cordoba. When the Vienna he learned to hold a gun. From Dublin to the Via del Reno, where he fought and died beneath the Spanish sun. Viva la Quinta Brigada. No passion around the pledge to live and fight. Adelante is the cry of us all and remember them tonight. Many Irish heard the call of Franco. Join Hitler and Mussolini too. Propaganda from the Portland newspaper. At the lucky two enlisted blue shirt group. And the word came from the church support the Nazis. And the men of Clovis failed again. But the bishops blessed the blue shirts in the Mary. And the sail beneath the swastika to Spain. This song is a tribute to Frank Ryan. That's Conway and Jimmy Cody too. A Peter Daly, Charlie Reagan and Jill Bonner. Though many died in them but never few. Tommy Doyle, the Lincoln and Charlie Donnelly. Jim Tomlinson and Jim Stanley from the fall. Jack Nanty, Tommy Patton and Frank Conroy. Jim Foley, Tony Fox and Dick O'Neill. Viva Quinta Brigada. No pastor and the pledge that made him fight. Adamanty is the cry around the hillside. And so remember them tonight.
Listening to Back in the USSR, you're on CFRU 93.3 FM, and that, of course, was Christy Moore with Viva la Quinta Brigada, celebrating the anti-fascist heroes of the international brigades who gave their lives in the Spanish Civil War. Now, and of course it needs to be pointed out, in that war, the Spanish fascists were actively supported by the Italian fascists, by the German Nazis, and really by the most Western countries, which of course basically blockaded the left-wing government of Spain at that time and effectively collaborated with the fascist takeover. Now, another thing that people are often ignorant about is where fascism comes from, who supports it, and who fascism supports with its violence and hate. And even though I did my master's thesis on this very subject years ago, Michael Parenti can still definitely say better than I can how fascism serves the interests of the capitalist ruling class and the profit motive more generally, and really only emerges when capitalism is in a crisis and ultimately protects capitalism at that particular point in history. So I'll play Michael's talk, The Functions of Fascism, which will explain the monster we're up against in much greater detail. So please stay tuned.
This is Michael Parenti, and welcome to Real History, a series of talks by me on different historical subjects that are relevant for understanding today's realities. Most people are never exposed to real history. In school, we usually don't read history, we read history textbooks, and mainstream ones at that, which avoid underlying realities and ones that propagate myths that serve the powers that be, myths that some of us find harmful to the truth and to democracy. So this is real history. This particular segment is entitled The Functions of Fascism. Fascism is a name that was given to the political movement that arose in Italy under the leadership of Benito Mussolini, who ruled that country from 1922 to 1943. Nazism, a similar movement led by Adolf Hitler, was Germany's dictator from 1933 to 45. It's considered by most observers to be a variant of fascism, as to a lesser degree is the militaristic government that controlled Japan from 1940 to 45, and the Falangist movement led by Francisco Franco in Spain, when the fascists there, with the military aid, by the way, of the Italian and Nazi fascists, took over after a protracted civil war. There are similar fascist or self-avowed fascist movements, but less successful ones arose in Eastern Europe and in Great Britain, the United States, France, and other Western industrial nations. Movements. Some of them also came to power. We might recall today, when the press is full of news about how Bulgaria or Romania or Hungary or Lithuania are returning, or Poland are returning to their democratic roots by overthrowing communism, we might recall that they weren't democratic before communism came in. They were fascist. In fact, several of those countries, with the exception of Poland, were open allies of the Nazis. They were Nazi fascist allies. Now, like with a lot of terms like liberalism, democracy, socialism, communism, no single definition of fascism maybe will satisfy everybody. And with fascism, there's a really special problem, because it's a beguiling mix of revolutionary-sounding mass appeals and reactionary class politics. And the reactionary class politics are the part of fascism that our establishment historians, almost never talk about. Hitler's party, for instance, was called the National Socialist German Workers' Party, the NSDAP, or Nazis. It's a very left-sounding name, National Socialist German Workers, and it was designed to win broad support among working people, even while the Nazis were destroying working-class organizations. In other words, fascism, the original Italian and German variations of fascism, was a political phenomenon that made a revolutionary appeal without making a revolution. It promised to solve the ills of the many while, in fact, protecting the special interests of the few with violence and terror. And it propagated a new political consciousness, a new order, a new nation to serve the same old capitalist system. Let me run down a couple of the major characteristics of the fascist ideology. First, there is a glorification of the leadership cult. The commitment to an absolutist and supreme leader, all-knowing, all-guiding, the Führerprinzip, as it's called, the Führer principle, the leader principle, I should say. Second, there's a glorification of the nation-state as an end in itself, as an entity unto itself, an absolute component, to which the individual is subsumed. Everything in the state, everything for the state, nothing outside of the state. That was Mussolini's dictum, and it was Hitler's also. In fact, with Hitler, Rudolf Hess once said, Adolf Hitler is Germany, Germany is Adolf Hitler, therefore combining both the leadership cult and the state cult in one. Third, there was a glorification of military conquest and jingoism, the glory of that the state is vitalized by subduing, conquering, taking other people, enslaving them, you increase your own power and your own glory. Fourth, there was the propagation of a folk mysticism, a xenophobia, and a racism. The Nazi slogan was, Ein Volk, ein Reich, ein Führer. One people, one state, one leader. Also, as a other side of the folk mysticism, and this blood cult of the special blood, the special legacy, the atavistic wonders of our particular people, was a xenophobia, a hatred and a racism, a hatred of other peoples, other nationalities. With the Nazis and with most other Eastern European fascists, it was anti-Semitism. The Jew was seen as the perpetrator of all that was ill in society. The trade unionists, they were Jews. The communists, so forth and so on. And behind them stood this wicked, alien-blooded creature who would undermine our state. Fifth, there was an opposition, both in Italian fascism and in German Nazism, an opposition to socialism, to communism, to anarchism, and to all left egalitarian class movements and doctrines, along with opposition to trade unions, opposition to labor parties, opposition to other working class political organizations. Of these various characteristics of Nazism, 1, 2, 3, 4 are often talked about by established historians and mainstream historians. That last one, though, opposition to labor unions, opposition to working class parties, opposition to socialism and such, that one is never talked about by Western writers, especially American writers. The historians and the political scientists and the journalists who treat the subject of fascism usually write from a centrist ideological perspective, from the political center of the spectrum, which means they usually ignore the link between fascism and capitalism, just as they tend to ignore the entire subject of capitalism itself when there's something unfavorable to say about it. Instead, they dwell on the more phantasmic components of fascist ideology, the nihilistic revolt against Western rationalism and individuality, the irrational appeals to mass submission to a leader and all that. And fascism was those things, but along with its irrational appeals, it had rational functions. It was a rational instrument for class domination and for the preservation of the existing capitalist system. After World War I, Italy had a parliamentary government that seemed really incapable of solving the country's economic crises. Profits were declining, banks were failing, unemployment was rising. So to ensure profits, the big industrial giants and the big landowners would have to slash wages and raise prices. The state, in turn, would have to provide the big owners with tariff protections along with massive subsidies and tax exemptions. To finance this, the population would have to be taxed more heavily, their wages rolled back, and social welfare expenditures drastically cut. It sounds like Reaganism. Well, it is, even more extremely so. But the government wasn't totally free to apply these harsh measures. First of all, Italian workers and peasants had their own unions, they had political organizations, they had cooperatives, they had their own publications, and through the use of demonstrations and strikes, boycotts, factory takeovers, occupying farmlands, the forcible occupation of farmlands, they often won some very real concessions in wages and work conditions, unemployment benefits, and they won the right to organize. But the government wasn't totally free to apply these harsh measures. First of all, Italian workers and peasants had their own unions. They had political...
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, and we're broadcasting Michael Parenti's talk, The Functions of Fascism, talking about the real history of how fascism emerged and how people fought back against it. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
But the government wasn't totally free to apply these harsh measures. First of all, Italian workers and peasants had their own unions, they had political organizations, they had cooperatives, they had their own publications, and through the use of demonstrations and strikes, boycotts, factory takeovers, occupying farmlands, the forcible occupation of farmlands, they often won some very real concessions in wages and work conditions, unemployment benefits, and they won the right to organize. And even in the face of this worsening economic crisis, they were able to mount a troublesome defense of their standard of living. I mean, troublesome for those who own the land, the labor, and the capital, and the money, and the banks, and the farms, and the factories. So the only solution really was to smash the worker and peasant organizations, in effect destroying all political and civil liberties, including the right to organize, agitate, and propagandize. The state would have to be more authoritarian and more firmly subservient to the interests of capital. Mussolini and his black shirts were around right after World War I, and for about 3 or 4 years, the big landowners and industrialists used their fascist goon squads, gave them money and gave them arms, and used them as kind of strike breakers, anti-labor militias. They styled themselves the United Front Against Bolshevism. In 1922, the big capital interests in Italy decided to go for the whole thing. Representatives of the Federation of Industry and the Federation of Agriculture, which was a agribusiness firm, and representatives of the National Banking Association, they all met together and they met with Mussolini, and they planned the fascist march on Rome. Mussolini sat there and planned that with the leading capitalists of Italy. By the way, this is almost never mentioned in the accounts about the march on Rome. These big capitalists contributed 20 million lira toward that undertaking. In the words of Senator Ettore Conti, himself a very loyal representative of the moneyed interests, quote, Mussolini was the candidate of the plutocracy, that is, of the wealthy, and the business associations. A very similar pattern, by the way, of coordination and compliance existed between in Germany also, less than a decade later. German workers and farm laborers in the period following World War I under the Weimar Republic won some important economic concessions. They won an eight-hour day, they won unemployment insurance, they were able to elect shop committees, and they won the right to unionize. And again, during the 1920s, these paramilitary right-wing gangs, most notably Hitler's brown shirts, stormtroopers, were subsidized by business in a limited way and kept as a kind of reserve army, what Gourin called the bodyguard of capitalism. And their job again was to strike, break, and to harass, organize workers, and to beat up socialists and communists and such. The nearly total collapse of the German economy in 1929-30 presented the owning class with a momentous crisis. They had very big capital investments, and these left them with very high fixed costs that had to be met even as their plants lay idle. Only massive state aid could revive their profits. Wages and social welfare, human service expenditures had to be cut. Union contracts had to be abrogated. In fact, human contracts had to be abrogated too. Business would need new subsidies and tax exemptions. The crisis in agriculture was equally severe, and the large landed proprietors, Junker class demanded even higher subsidies, heavier duties on foreign agricultural imports, and an end to farm unions. These unions were holding wages up, and when wages were being sustained, you cut into profits. So by 1930, most of the influential landowners and big industrialists and bankers, especially the industrialists in steel, coal, and mining, had concluded that the Weimar Republic no longer served their interests, and no longer could protect their class, that it was too accommodating to the working class and to certain sectors of light industry. So they greatly increased their subsidies to Hitler, and they propelled the Nazi Party onto the national stage. By 1930, most of the great industrialists and bankers were underwriting the Nazi Party. And what happened in 1930 with this injection of hundreds of millions of marks is that Hitler was able to catapult his party onto the national scene. It went from a cult of brown shirt thugs to a national party mobilized. In the election of 1930, the Nazi Party gained 107 seats in the Reichstag. And Hitler, later on, evoking the memory of what he called that astonishing campaign, told his listeners to think of, quote, what it means when 1,000 speakers each has a car at his disposal and can hold in a year 100,000 meetings. And in 1931 and 32, the subsidies from the big industrialists continued to grain in ever more abundantly. So the Nazis were projected onto the national stage, and they gained an ever larger presence in the Reichstag. Neither in Italy nor in Germany was revolution really something that was in the offing. I mean, it wasn't a real threat. The left was never strong enough to take state power in either of those countries. So the threat wasn't really from the left. The bourgeoisie resorted to fascism less in response to the disturbances in the street and more in response to the disturbances in their own economic system. The threat wasn't from the left. The threat was from their own economic systems and its contradictions, and the fact that democratic forces had developed enough democratic strength to resist the austerity and the rollback that the capitalists tried to impose to maintain their levels of profit. The sickness that these capitalists tried to banish was from within, not from without. The Italian and German monopolists, the big cartels, also had a direct interest in an expansionist military regime. They wanted a big rebuilding of the military, one that would, one, compensate, first of all, would compensate for the decline in investment opportunities with huge armament contracts, and related public works. In other words, this industrial and financial class wanted a large defense budget, as we would call it, because it was a source of capital investment and enormous capital profits. Does that sound familiar? Two, they wanted to embark on an aggressive foreign policy to open new markets for export and investment, thereby gaining a more equal footing with French and English competitors. So the fascists really became a very valuable ally against the capitalists' two worst enemies. The capitalists' two worst enemies are, first, the workers in their own country, and the capitalists of foreign countries. And the genuineness, by the way, of fascism's hatred of workers and foreigners was never open to doubt, so they fit in quite snugly. Now, I don't mean to say that all the big industrialists and financiers supported fascism with equal fervor. Some, like Tyson, were early and enthusiastic backers of Hitler. The aged Emil Kerdorf thanked God that he lived long enough to see the Führer emerge as the savior of Germany. Others contributed money to the Nazis, but also to other anti-socialist parties on the right. They backed Hitler only when he promised to be the best hope for their interests. By the way, many of them still remain privately critical of the more extreme expressions of Nazi propaganda, and they were a little uneasy about the anti-bourgeois rhetoric sometimes used by some of the fascist plebeian elements.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, you were playing Michael Parenti's talk, Functions of Fascism, talking about how fascism emerged in the 1920s and 30s and how people fought back against it. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
They backed Hitler only when he promised to be the best hope for their interests. By the way, many of them still remain privately critical of the more extreme expressions of Nazi propaganda, and they were a little uneasy about the anti-bourgeois rhetoric sometimes used by some of the fascist plebeian elements. Some elements in business were not that hot for fascism. Light industry, which had lower fixed costs and more stable profits than heavy industry that was dependent on consumer buying power and such, the light industrialists were not that keen about a more aggressive foreign policy, about heavy subsidies to heavy industry and the like. But when push came to shove, they may not have been close to the fascists, but they weren't about to ally themselves with the proletariat against the business class of which they were a part. And they pretty much sided with the dominant elements or kept their mouths shut. There was another element in these two societies that not only tolerated the rise of fascism, but supported it. And I'm talking about the parliamentary capitalist state itself. Not the government or the parliament as such, but the instruments of the state, the instruments that have the legal monopoly on force and violence, the police, the army, the courts, and the like, the secret intelligence agencies and such. In both Italy and Germany, years before Mussolini and Hitler emerged victorious, these elements, courts, police, the army, showed a real leniency and an open collaboration with fascism while harshly repressing the left. Mussolini and Hitler could not have come to power without the help of the state machineries, and that state machinery was never really against them. In Italy, the police collaborated with the fascists in attacking labor and peasant organizations. They recruited criminals for the fascist action squads, the squadristi, as they call it, squadristi. They promised them immunity from prosecution for past crimes. When applications for gun permits were regularly denied to workers and peasants, police guns and police cars were made available to Mussolini's goons. Germany, the same kind of thing went on. Immediately after the war, the military police and the judiciary sided with the rightists to suppress the left, a pattern of collaboration that continued to the day that Hitler took power. In other words, these supposed democracies, which were equally opposed to totalitarianism of the left and the right, were not equally opposed. They were opposed to the left, and they were very close and comfy with the right. Because the right, while it was out to destroy that democracy, the right was protecting the interests of property and the existing class structure. And that's the difference between the left and the right, and that's why a capitalist state tends to treat the right so much more leniently and the left so much more harshly. Let's look at what happened by the police and the courts under the Weimar Republic. These are the figures. Left-wing groups were charged with 22 murders, 38 people on the left were found guilty for those 28 murders. They averaged 15 years in prison. 10 of those 38 were executed. Among right-wing groups, 354 murders. What is that? That's about 60 times more the number of murders. Of these 354 murders, 326 were not even prosecuted. 23 were discharged. 23 people of the right-wing groups were discharged despite entering guilty pleas. They pleaded guilty to the murder and they were discharged. 24 were found guilty in part. Their average term in prison, 4 months. The number of them executed for the murders, none. So that's the way the state operated. Almost all the literature on fascism and Nazism concentrates on who supported Hitler, who supported Mussolini, who was behind him. Was it this group or that group and such? Oh, there was a couple of millionaires who didn't like them. Oh, there were some workers who did vote for them. So you can't really say it's one class or another. Well, I think you could pretty well say which class gave them the money, that gave them the visibility, the organization, and the numbers to some degree. But there's something else. Besides talking about who supported fascism, one thing these historians and political scientists never talk about is who did fascism support when fascism came into power. Who did the fascists support? Well, in Italy and Germany, when they came into power, they began implementing the stern measures that were needed to rescue the capitalist economy. Labor unions were dissolved. Strikes were outlawed. Union contracts were nullified. Prominent union leaders and other labor activists were imprisoned or murdered. Union property was confiscated. Worker publications were banned. Opposition political parties were outlawed. Their leaders jailed. Civil liberties were suspended. Fascist-sponsored unions, quote, unions, were set up, and their function was to speed up production, prevent wildcat strikes, and apply punitive regulations, including fines, dismissals, and imprisonments against workers who agitated or complained of shop conditions. I mean, even a Nazi Labor Front newspaper had to admit, quote, some shop regulations are reminiscent of penal codes. Workers no longer had the right to change jobs. They could be shifted from one employment to another regardless of their wishes. They could be conscripted for any work assumed useful to the nation's economy without guarantee of wages equal to previous earnings. In both Italy and Germany, the government exercised compulsory arbitration and regulation of work and wages. By the way, any worker who contested that would be contesting the laws of the state and therefore would be declared an enemy of the state, not just in conflict with management, but an enemy of the state. And so, in effect, what you got was a perfect wedding of the interests of the state and the interests of the capitalist class in this particular capitalist state. And by the way, these measures had their effect. According to figures supplied by the Italian press itself, the already meager wages, you know, the wages weren't all that good to begin with, for Italian workers in 1927 were cut in half by 1932. By 1939, the cost of living had risen 30%, and this constituted an additional decrease in real wages. Taxes on wages were introduced. Regulations were instated against minimum wages. The minimum wage law was abolished, in other words. There was no more increased pay for overtime. In some regions, sanitary and safety regulations were dropped. Occupational safety regulations were eliminated in factories. In many areas, child labor was reintroduced. In other words, all the old abuses and old evils that the Italians thought were dead, that belonged to a generation ago, had returned under fascism. In Germany, the same story. Between 1933 and 1935, wages were lowered anywhere from 25 to 40%. That's a tremendous cut if you're an ordinary worker just trying to make ends meet. Wage taxes were instituted. Municipal poll taxes were doubled. Payroll deductions helped finance the Nazi-controlled labor front. And the Nazi labor front controlled the party organizations and the health and unemployment insurances, all of which, by the way, lowered wages another 20 and 30%. That is, the things that were taken out of your pay for that. And the non-profit mutual assistance and insurance associations that had existed before the Nazis came to power and the free labor unions were abolished. Their funds were taken over by private insurance companies that charged more while paying out smaller benefits. So, and in Italy, in Germany, just like in Italy, inflation substantially added to the German workers' hardship. There's something else both of these fascist leaders did. In both Italy and Germany, the process of privatization. Does that sound familiar? Ronald Reagan's dream. State-owned enterprises such as power plants, steel mills, banks, railways, insurance firms, steamship companies, and shipyards were handed